From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next hour as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 16 of Little Brother, dated 10th of August, 2001. Stay tuned, Little Brother is right around the corner. Thanks for tuning in and joining us. The show is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. The topic is technology. And before we get started, I need to remind our listeners that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRPI staff or management, the Rensselaer Student Union, or Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. The phone lines here at WRPI, area code 518-276-6248, and I'd love to hear from you. That number again, 518-276-6248. If you're feeling a little bit shy, don't want to call us, you can always send us email also. Email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That address again, critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop, all one word, .com. Last but not least, if you want to send us snail mail, the address here at WRPI is WRPI 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180. So with the preliminaries out of the way, let's get started. We're going to start off tonight, as usual, with a bunch of items that came off of the Comp.Risks news group on Usenet. The Register is reporting that Windows XP Release Candidate 2 has a driver block that will prevent a number of programs from running. Some people are apparently worried that Microsoft might become too bossy about software that their operating system can run. We'll do more on this one later. Code Red may or may not be the major disaster that the CERT predicted. It is certainly present and apparently mutating already. What does not seem to have happened is the production of an effective stopper for Code Red. Present prophylactic activities involve getting as many systems as possible updated with the fix. This, of course, will not work as a large number of systems are run out of the box by people with little or no technical training. They won't even know how to recognize that they have the worm, never mind fix it. One simple fix is a passive worm that sits on the target machine when a Code Red attack arrives, infects the attacker using the same technique that the Code Red uses. By definition, an attacking machine must be vulnerable to the attack. The passive worm could disinfect the attacker and then sit waiting for further attacks on the original machine, plus on the newly disinfected attacker. The rate of spread of the passive worm would be directly proportional to the spread of Code Red. The passive worm cannot spread at all unless Code Red is operating. The passive worm would almost certainly disable the IIS service. In fact, it might be a good idea to have it produce a default web page stating so, together with instructions on how to download the security fix. An improved version may even apply the fix itself. The question arises as to whether a passive worm is illegal in any way. The arguments for a passive worm are that the system it is defending is under attack, and it's taking steps to stop the attack. As a byproduct, the attacker is unable to attack any other systems. The attacker does not suffer any damage as a result of the disinfection. The argument against it is that the defender places and executes code on the hostile machine. This may well breach any number of antivirus laws. The real test of the argument will be when a very dangerous worm, say like Code Red but 100 times as potent, is unleashed. The various governments will be left in the serious dilemma as to whether to allow a vital national resource to be destroyed or to unleash a probably illegal antidote. The timescale to make such a decision could be a matter of hours from first discovery to internet meltdown. governments and Microsoft must have a contingency in plan in place. I wonder what it is. More on that one later also. Una Smith submits to us as follows. I called AT&T WorldNet customer support to ask a question about my bill. My question was entirely impersonal, but nonetheless I was required to identify myself. I gave my name and current telephone number. The service rep then asked me for the number I had had when I signed up. When I hesitated, she volunteered it. Then she asked for my email password. When I refused, she informed me that my password is not a secret and that all passwords connected to my WorldNet account, and WorldNet account can have up to 6 email accounts, are visible on her screen. Jim Horning throws this item in. He says, this was sent to him from a company that shall remain anonymous. It said, quote, we want to make you aware that the HR database will be unavailable from 6 p.m. on Friday, August 3rd to 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, August 5th due to server upgrades. During this time, you will not be able to access the website in such and such a supplier's ongoing effort to improve site performance. These upgrades are occurring to load balance and increase site stability. Part of this site upgrade includes a password change. All users will have a password of change 123 as of 12:01 Monday, August 6, 2001. Once you enter the system for the first time, on or after August 6th, you will be required to change your password and answer a secret question. In the future, you will be able to use the answer to the question to reset your own password. If you experience problems, please contact the Where I Work help desk at insert the support line here. I don't think that actually needs much commentary, but I'm going to throw it out anyway. The obvious failing to this particular system is that should somebody come along and stumble upon the site while it's in this particular state where all the passwords are changed 123, or worse yet, should somebody be aware of it, say, for example, they work for one of the companies that this outsourced supplier supplies, it would be very easy to hijack anybody and everybody's accounts on the system. And since it's an HR database, there's a lot of personal information in there that needs not be spread. Bob Green wrote this. He says, I recently received a new AT&T Universal Credit Card, Visa card. The card came with a security callback activation feature where you call an 800 number and enter your card number. If you're calling from home and presumably have not blocked the caller ID feature, this call activates the card. The part of the procedure that surprised me was that after typing in my card number, the voice response system cautioned me to stay on the line until I've heard a confirmation that my card was activated, then launched into 30-second advertisement for a form of disability insurance. The insurance is sold with a 3-month trial period, after which the insurance is automatically charged to your card. They asked me to type 1 to purchase the insurance or 2 not to purchase the insurance. Then it asked a second time to type 1 to purchase the insurance. Finally, after 2 presses of 2, the voice confirmed activating my card. Besides being quite annoyed at being solicited in this manner, I had a moment of panic at the first question. Voice response systems that ask you to enter 1 to confirm a request are very common. Was this confirmation request to activate the card or to purchase the insurance? It took a moment of reflection to assure myself that I was saying no to the insurance. The risks are that one might accidentally purchase insurance that they don't want, might feel forced to buy the insurance in order to activate the card, or hang up too soon and not activate the card. Given the confusion that's often intentionally introduced by creative marketing, mixing advertising and security procedures seems like a very poor practice. Brian Webb writes, in South Carolina, a new law on education standards for daycare workers has a requirement that private technicians tell police if they find child pornography when servicing computers. Think of the possibilities. You're servicing computers and you get the idea to have some fun. You take a client's computer, roll the date back, access some child pornography websites, reset the date, and call the cops. Carrying it one step further, imagine that this is a political dirty trick. It might just be the mayor or some legislative representative who gets victimized. And who would believe any protestations of innocence? Andrew Koenig writes, this evening I wanted to connect a laptop to the internet and download updated virus definition files. I tried placing a call, then realized that I didn't know whether the machine was set up correctly for my present location, so I canceled the call. After checking the machine, I thought it looked reasonable, so I tried again. 5 minutes later, two police officers showed up at my door saying that they'd received a 911 call from my home. It took me a while to put together what had happened. Because I wanted to update the virus definition files, I called from administrator rather than from my own account. The last time I dialed out on the machine as administrator was from a hotel room in San Antonio, Texas. On the other hand, the phone number to dial for the ISP had since been changed back home in New Jersey. The default area code for a dial-up connection is 1, which happens to be the same as the country code for the USA. Therefore, when setting the ISP's phone number, I had mistakenly assumed that the area code would go along with the phone number and specified an area code of 1, which I thought was the correct country code of 1, and a phone number of 908 followed by 7 digits instead of just the 7 digits, as it should have been. The network dialer, which still thought I was in the hotel room, dialed 9 for an outside line, 1 for a tow call, and 1 again for what it thought was the area code, and then 908 and 7 digits, which was ignored. I suppose the risks are obvious. And actually, we spoke about this one last week. Been some comment in on the Risks Digest recently of the subject of online advertising as seen from the perspective of a web surfer. From the viewpoint of a webmaster seeking ad income, there are interesting aspects of what seems to be a novel form of a denial of service attack. I'll focus on one particular advertising model known as the cost per click, or CPC. In this mechanism, a website will display a banner for an advertiser, and when a surfer clicks on the banner, the advertiser will pay a small sum to the publisher of the website. Thus, the publisher will receive an income dependent on the CPC multiplied by the click-through ratio, or CTR. A simple click may cost an advertiser anywhere between 2 and 50 cents, and there's normally an agency of some sort between the two parties to see fair play, count the clicks, handle payments, etc. One fairly obvious risk is that the advertiser who wants brand awareness and not clicks can get free advertising by running ads that don't get clicked, but which enhance brand recognition. Of course, advertisers, or more commonly the agencies with whom they deal, take whatever steps they can to combat such fraud. One route used by many is just to have a cutoff point for the click-through ratio and say that a website with a high click-through ratio will automatically be barred for fraud. Clearly, this leads to the normal risk of false positives where a legitimate site with a high click-through ratio is excluded. Interestingly, the false positives will work to exclude the sites which are the best ones for the advertiser to use. For example, let's suppose that a dating agency specializing in women from Russia seeking men from the West uses an agency to run its banner ads on the websites represented by the agency. Most of the time, such ads will attract a click-through ratio of about 0.2%. But what if one of the sites the ad agency network happens to specialize in is on advice on exactly this topic, fiancé visas, how to address a letter to a country that uses the Cyrillic alphabet, etc.? That site may see a click-through ratio of over 5%, which will rapidly earn it exclusion for fraud. Of course, that's exactly the site on which the advertiser would like to run its ads. And the novel denial of service attack? Well, recent reports on web publisher forums at geekvillage.com have focused on another problem. Suppose that two sites are in competition, and they cover the same subject area and target the same pool of surfers and advertisers. Site A runs banner ads, and Site B would like to get those ads for itself, and B would set, and perhaps even close down Site A and get the surfers too. The operator of Site B could set up a click bot to cause open proxy servers to send thousands of clearly false clicks to the advertiser, seemingly on behalf of Site A. Site A will then be flagged for fraud and lose its advertising income and may well close. If you have an opinion on any of these items, please give a call, area code 518-276-6248. Any topic that I've covered, any topic that I'm going to cover, any topic you want to cover, the phones are open. Give a call. Last week we spoke about a person who had gone to purchase some airline tickets and accidentally discovered that due to the website crashing, or actually I believe it was a phone-in system, crashing in mid-transaction and telling him to try the transaction again, he did a second transaction and in fact ended up with two sets of airline tickets. It was mentioned at the time that the airline computer system normally would have caught duplicate airline tickets and canceled one set. We have a follow-up to that one. This comes from, actually we have a few of them. This one comes from Terry Brugger, who says, I recently had a similar experience with Ticketmaster's online ordering system. I was buying a ticket to a show by my favorite artist. As soon as the tickets went on sale, I wanted a good seat. Unfortunately, the group has many other fans in the area, so the system was quite sluggish and timed out frequently. I selected the seat I wanted, entered in all of my info, and submitted it. After waiting a minute or two, it came back with an error message to the effect of, unable to confirm your order, hit the back button and resubmit it. When I did, I was informed that my session timed out and I should try again from the beginning, so I did. 5 times before the order went through and was confirmed. Everyone knows what happened next. I ended up with 5 tickets. Ticketmaster was nice enough about it, but still left me with the task of mailing in back the unwanted tickets in order to receive my refund. The risk, if you're going to build a system with the primary task of selling tickets to popular events, first, make sure that it can handle the load when those events go on sale, and second, make sure that it correctly reports the completion of transactions. Joe Thompson wrote about it, saying, I recently had such an incident with my bank based in Maryland. I used the online banking tools to transfer some funds from one account to another. Later that day, I had a need to stop payment on a check, so I again logged on and transferred enough money back into the first account to cover the stop payment fee. Later that night, I withdrew some funds from the second account on an ATM, and my receipt showed the correct balance. The next night, I did the same thing, total withdrawal $60 for the 2 transactions, and the following day at lunch, I tried to make a withdrawal on an ATM and was denied, with the receipt showing a balance of approximately negative $60 in the second account. You guessed it, the online transfers I had made disappeared from the system, and the balances snapped back to what they would have been had they never happened. The customer support people fortunately believed me, in part because it's impossible to have a negative balance in a savings account without some really odd goings-on. And later that week, it turned out to be a good thing because the chaos of the few days resulted in 2 checks that were currently going through the system bouncing. The bank refunded the insufficient funds fees, and the payees never knew because the 2 payments were made via the bank's online payment, which sends the equivalent of a cashier's check, i.e., it can't bounce. The risk, of course, is the old story. Adding new systems adds complexity and can have entirely unexpected results. Lastly, John Hayes has this to say about it. He says, the software that prevents duplicate transactions can be a problem in and of itself. I recently attempted to make hotel reservations through an online travel agency. On this particular site, there was no provision for reserving multiple rooms, so after making the first reservation, I went back and attempted to reserve a second room. The Watchdog software would not allow me to reserve a second room in my name. I ended up having to use a different name in order to make a reservation for the second room. Eventually, this website does allow you to consolidate multiple reservations, but that was not at all clear as I struggled with the system. Note, for the trip home, I decided to just phone the hotel directly and talk to an operator in order to make similar reservations. It was much easier. Take a moment now for a quick break. You're listening to Little Brother on WRPI Troy. You're listening to Little Brother. Okay, this item comes to us from Nikolai Langenfeldt, who lives in Norway. He says, EDB Fellesdata AS runs the computer services of about half of Norway's banks. On Thursday, 2nd of August 2001, they apparently installed about 280 disks in their Hitachi storage. Then, instead of initializing the new disks, they initialized all of their disks, thereby wiping out the entire data warehouse. EDB Fellesdata itself declines to make any statements in the case, pending further contact with their customers, the banks. They are considering lawsuits, but if one of their employees made a user error, they may have a hard time of it. Talk about a lot of eggs in one basket. One can only imagine how many terabytes of database this is, considering the number of disks and how long it takes to restore them from backup, and how many transactions were waiting to be processed from other banks once the restore is done. Apparently, the computers were running by Sunday. Card services and ATMs were available on Monday, but internet banking and automatic phone banking access is limited. They have announced that updated account balances will not be available until Wednesday, the 7th day after the mishap. The concerned bank's customers could pay their bills by visiting a local branch of the office the whole time, but apparently the transactions had not been processed because creditors have been warned that the money may be late in arriving, but presumably retrocredited once the transaction is processed. Declan McCulloch writes, the German encryption program Safeguard Easy has been broken by the Danish police. The police from the city Holstebro in Jutland presented evidence in court that was provided after breaking the encryption on 5 out of 16 computers that were seized on April 25th of this year. All 16 computers were protected with Safeguard Easy from the German encryption provider Utimico. It is not known whether DES, 128-bit IDEA, Blowfish, or Stealth was used as the algorithm on the computers. All four algorithms are built in the built into Safeguard Easy. Details are sparse, and it's not known how the encryption was broken, whether it was brute forced or flaws in the program were exploited. The computers were seized from the humanitarian foundation Dvind in connection with a case about tax evasion. Among the evidence provided from the encryption computers were emails sent among the leaders of the foundation, Poul Jorgensen and Morgans Andy Peterson, describing transfers of large sums of money. Apparently, but not confirmed, British Scotland Yard has been involved in breaking the encryption. The Danish police don't have the capacity to break encryption by themselves. Neither has the Danish Civilian Intelligence Service. Routine is that cases concerning encryption are handed over to the Danish Defense Intelligence Service, DDIS. This procedure has been described earlier by the Danish Minister of Justice in connection with another case. DDIS denies involvement with the Dvend case. Employees and leaders at Dvend have denied handing over their passwords to the computers. One even wrote a public letter mocking the chief of police in Holstebro, describing how he changed his password weekly and stating that he'd probably even forgotten his password by now. At a time, the police had considered putting employees in custody until passwords were handed over. The short message text servicing, SMS, enables short messages from one cell phone to another. Muslim authorities had previously permitted men to divorce their wives by SMS. In April to June of 2001, 16 divorces were so reported in Singapore. However, now the Islamic Religious Council of Singapore, the Sharia Court, and the Registry of Muslim Marriages are unanimous in their view that divorce through SMS is unacceptable. Only a judge can confirm a divorce after deciding that there is merit in complaint filed by the couple with the Sharia Court. Ouch. Imagine that one, will you? Can you imagine, from a woman's point of view, you're wandering around town and your cell phone beeps and you look at it and there's a message on it saying that you're divorced. Just wham bam and it's done. Unimaginable. It's unimaginable that anybody, any place in the world, any place sophisticated enough to have cell phones with SMS capability would be allowing such a thing. But then again, I guess I can't really pass judgment on other cultures. What's your opinion? Let's hear it. Area code 518-276-6248 is the number if you want to voice yours. In Japan, Omron Corporation plans to deliver your stolen car and the wretched villain inside it right to the nearest police box. Imagine that someone steals your car and a network of sensors in the vehicle knows the person driving is not the right person. So it uses the global positioning satellite system. It makes the car stop outside the nearest koban, that's a police box, and locks the driver inside. This is what I imagine. This is the next stage. That those words from Shinichi Mukigawa, an engineer at Omron's Business Incubation Center who has designed the basic elements for such a system. How very risky. How lovely. Hijack somebody's car using this system, park it next to an empty koban, and let the Yakuza do their thing. Amazing. Computer passwords and personal information about participants in Georgia's Hope Scholarship Program were inadvertently exposed on the web as early as December of 2000. The information was apparently cached by several search engines, including Google. From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution of August 8, 2001, last November 14th, a member of the agency's technical staff copied a file onto the Hope computer system that prevents internet search engines from indexing the system's contents. But another program in the system deletes unused files after 30 days. So about December 15th, the security file was wiped out, exposing other files. It's not clear what security file was accidentally removed. The news articles that have been presented about this have not named the file. I'm guessing, now this is from Rachel Slatkin, who submitted this to comp.risks. I'm guessing it was either robots.txt or .htaccess, hopefully the latter. Many system administrators have discovered the risks of deleting unused files without being sure of their purpose. Having the procedure happen automatically compounds the problem. And I'm going to tell you, I am not going to be proud about this one. I'm going to confess to having pulled that little stunt myself. Had a program ripped through a system that deleted any files that were more than 90 days old, or more accurately, that hadn't been accessed in 90 days, not that were 90 days old. And it deleted a file that is needed at boot time. As it happens, the computer had not been booted in approximately 100 days. And shortly thereafter, it got rebooted. And guess what? It didn't happen. This comes from somebody who identifies himself simply as Dave. It was not the kind of Kodak moment the city of Lakewood had hoped for. Its high-tech traffic camera had just nabbed Sim Mason for doing 38 in a 30-mile-an-hour zone. The camera captured the license plate on the Tacoma woman's car as it sped through a school zone on June 8th, or so it seemed. After receiving a notice, a thumbnail copy of the incriminating image, and a demand for $71, she put pen to paper and wrote, "This is my sworn statement under penalty of perjury that your system cannot distinguish between the sporty coupe shown in the ticket picture and the Honda CR-V sport utility vehicle that I drive. In other words, I swear that you have the wrong car since the one shown in the ticket is not my vehicle. Is this sufficient to correct your error, or would you like me to swear at you some more?" Nice to see somebody can keep their sense of humor under those circumstances. Our friends Adobe are back. Last week we mentioned that they'd been installing a mysterious file of their own that regularly calls home for reasons unknown. Peter Wehner writes, "Perhaps this kind of reporting software is necessary, but it may be the reason why I'm slowly giving up on Adobe products. My version of InDesign crashes frequently. My version of ImageReady has the strangest bug. If my system's been up for a bit, ImageReady refuses to run. If I reboot, it's fine. I suspect this has got something to do with the quick blip of the network access LED on the router that flickers just after starting up. Maybe that little phone home program doesn't say the right thing to ImageReady. I thought about complaining or investigating, but I decided that making the transition to GIMP is much simpler. This topic has been on my mind while I've been working on creating simple watermarks for a pay-per-copy experiment. I considered complicated encryption mechanisms and gave up. The complexity took too long to develop, and excluded too many legitimate customers. In the end, I just insert the purchaser's name in the file on the way out the door. Now, this kind of watermark may be easy to defeat, but that has advantages. First, bright kids get no boost from hacking the system. It's trivial, but it's still complex enough to require someone to take a positive step to defeat it. If they can live with themselves, well, they'll get enough punishment. Finally, there's no complexity to crash systems and drive users nuts. Alright, this next item comes to us from The Register at www.theregister.co.uk. Supposedly, they call themselves the biting the hand that feeds IT, which is kind of cool, I think. Anyway, they said, although Release Candidate 2 of Windows XP is billed as a bug fix, it actually implements a long-promised feature that disables current versions of some users' most trusted software. At the 11th hour, Microsoft has turned on driver blocking, and RC2 refuses to install a host of third-party applications, including Black Ice, Zone Alarm, and AOL, users who need to upgrade their applications to Windows XP-compliant versions. The authors of Black Ice and Zone Alarm assured us that versions will be updated to take account of the major networking changes in Windows XP. They said, we've been working closely with Microsoft. Black Ice is widely used inside Microsoft in order to make sure that it works well. Rob Graham, the founder of Network Ice, had told us. Graham is the chief architect at Internet Security Systems, which acquired Network Ice in June. Graham said that version 3.0 of Black Ice would be released shortly and it would be Windows XP compliant. Zone Labs, the authors of Zone Alarm, told us that users need to be using version 2.6.214 of the software and ensure that they have an upgrade from Windows 98. Microsoft alerted software authors and device driver writers to the changes earlier that year, and a Word document that they sent out describes what's necessary. Software needs to carry the XP-compliant logo to run. That's just the way the world works, shrugged Graham. When you're working with firewalls, you're mucking about with system internals, and that's always going to change. But not everyone is happy. Several Register readers are alarmed that Microsoft has launched a proscribed list, likening it to the closed world of games consoles. If Microsoft got into the business of deciding which programs you may run on your system, that's a pretty scary thing. Most companies don't have the time or resources to go through the Microsoft certification program, writes one concerned reader. And even though it's doubtless there for the best intentions, the move echoes the anti-competitive behavior that Microsoft engage in against Digital Research's DR-DOS. Users running early versions of Windows on DR-DOS ran into spurious error messages that Microsoft later admitted were generated at the request of the product managers to create instability concerns amongst users where no genuine instability existed. Anxious readers should check the following... anxious readers to check the following file in a hex editor in the Windows XP release candidate 2. Go to WinNT appatch or the directory where appatch under wherever your system root is, and open the binary file apphelp.sdb. The proscribed applications should be clearly readable. And that's not a misprint. The file really is called apphelp. We've got a listener letter here that came in. By the way, you can send yours in, too. Email address, again, is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. And postal address is Little Brother, care of WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180. Or you could give us a call and voice your opinion at 518-276-6248. Anyway, I'm not exactly sure how this user pronounces his handle. I believe it's pronounced Defargem. And he says, interesting idea from the caller who connected the American held in Moscow with the Russian charged here recently. We'll have to see, now that the American is released, if the charges are dropped. Actually, the Russian is probably more valuable, and they may be after even more, they may be after even more in return. Well, I'll tell you something. Last week, the caller who pointed out that maybe the arrest of the Russian programmer was a result of revenge for the American who was arrested in Russia for spying, did spark quite a bit of discussion in my circles, which is kind of interesting. It seems like nobody had thought to put these two ideas together. Now, Defargem here points out that the American has been released. Interestingly enough, the Russian has also been released. Let me see if I can find that. Got it. This item is actually off of Yahoo News. They said came through them through Reuters. It says Russian software programmer Dmitry Skliarov, whose July 16th arrest on U.S. copyright charges provoked a firestorm of debate over internet free speech, was released on $50,000 bail by a California court. Skliarov, 26, was released into the custody of Sergei Osokine of nearby Cupertino, California, after his Moscow-based company, Elcomsoft, put up the $50,000 bond, court officials said. Skliarov appeared in court for the bail hearing, looking tired and wearing orange prison-issued clothing. Outside the court, a small group of protesters demonstrated, saying his arrest was a violation of free speech rights. Skliarov's arrest on July 16th at a Las Vegas hackers convention made him the first person to be prosecuted under the controversial U.S. Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which bans the creation or distribution of technology that can be used to circumvent copy protection. Skliarov wrote a program that allows people who purchase books in digital form and use the Adobe System's ebook reader to make them and transfer copies of the book. Legal under Russian law, but a violation of the DMCA. And I'm going to say something here which I think is very important. I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again now, because even though this is at the risk of sounding redundant, it must be understood that the law under which Dmitry Skliarov was arrested should not in any way have applied to the particular crime that he is alleged to have committed, because Skliarov was on Russian soil, working for a Russian company, for producing a Russian product. Where does America fit into that? We cannot really go around the world applying our laws to citizens of other nations until and unless they commit some crime during a visit to the U.S. If they commit something that would be a crime, commit an act that would be a crime on U.S. soil, while they themselves are not on U.S. soil, then we should have no say in it whatsoever. We have a caller. So let's see what we have here. Hello, caller. You're on Little Brother.
Yes, you have a caller. Okay, I was just wondering, you got any idea if this is an extraditable offense that he allegedly committed?
It is not, as far as I know, because of the fact that the offense was not committed in America. The offense was not an offense where it was committed.
Okay,
case closed.
So what exactly was the offense he allegedly committed again?
Okay, Dmitry Skliarov wrote a program that makes it possible for somebody to download an ebook that was put together using the Adobe format, and those come out encrypted so that they can't be freely printed and redistributed, obviously for copyright concerns. He wrote a program that broke the encryption on this, and when he wrote this program, he was in a location where writing such a program is not a crime.
Okay, so if it's not a crime over there, it's probably not an extraditable offense.
That's what I'm saying. That's the way I read it. Now, obviously, I'm not a lawyer, and this is only my opinion. But I'm not alone in having this opinion. And I really, honestly, and truly believe that we can't be arresting people on U.S. soil, although on U.S. soil, for acts that were committed outside of U.S. soil that were not a crime where they were committed, even if a crime on U.S. soil.
Okay, well, let
me take one more step here before you go on. Let us take polygamy, for example. There are nations of the world where polygamy is the standard. A man will have many wives. When these people come and travel to the U.S., they are allowed to maintain the status of being married to all of those women, even though on U.S. soil that is not legal. It's not a crime because of the fact that the place where the act was committed, it was not a crime. Had they tried to do that on U.S. soil, of course, there would have been repercussions for that.
Okay. My understanding is, just for what the 2 cents is worth and not much more, is if they immigrate, they can only bring one wife.
That may very well be true.
I believe that was a problem with some of the Hmong refugees from Laos after the war.
Yeah, that may very well be true. Let me use a better example.
Okay,
perhaps,
what if he threatened to shoot the president of the United States while living in Russia and then come here?
I'm not so sure. I want to go there. That's a pretty big item.
It seems like a fun intellectual game to play, though.
Well, let me take another tack on this one.
Okay, let me point something else out. Did you say that he was released on, what was his bail?
$50,000.
But wasn't it a bond?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any idea where the bond came from?
Yes, his company picked up the tab for it.
Well, his company bought the bond.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But did it come from a bail bondsman, do you know? Because if you buy a bond, if you get bail from a bail bondsman, you normally only put up like 10% of that $50,000. So that means that his company probably only had to put up $5,000 to get him out of jail, which sounds a little strange considering if he's a Russian citizen, what's his flight risk, you know?
Actually, I have heard people discuss that potential, but last I had heard, he was behaving himself. He was staying in Northern California where he's supposed to be.
Okay, because I just think it's a lot of people don't understand the bail system. If you often your bail does not actually have to be posted, you just have to have it available so they can take it from you if you don't turn in, and that's
right.
What the bondsmen specialize in doing.
Right. Well, I was going to also point out that I was going to give another example. There are laws on the books in other nations of the world. France comes to mind. In France, it is not legal to distribute Nazi literature. Now, granted, this is a heinous act, in my humble opinion. I hate Nazis with a passion, but here in America, they have free speech just like everybody else. If somebody was in the U.S. distributing Nazi literature and then went to France, and in France did not distribute Nazi literature, would it be appropriate for the French to arrest him? My thought is that it is not. I don't care about the fact that this guy is probably the worst scumbucket in the world.
Or just to twist that around to something more acceptable, to advocate independence for Tibet from China and then take a trip to China.
Right.
You know, do the Chinese have a right to arrest such a person? I would hope not.
I would hope not, too. Of course, the other side of it is that that other nations are going to follow different sets of rules in dealing with foreign nationals than the U.S. is, but I picked on France because of the fact that I consider them to be a reasonably Western nation. Yes, we'll
put
it that way.
They're reasonably European.
Yes, yes.
Those French.
Yeah, reasonably civilized by American standards.
And overly civilized by French standards.
Possibly, I don't know.
Okay.
This is starting to go in all kinds of directions that it probably shouldn't.
Oh, okay. But you said earlier, I guess I don't have a right to judge foreign cultures. I think you do.
Do you think so?
Yes. Well, I don't know. It's a very complex issue, but sometimes you just have to.
Well, I suppose so.
And
it just struck me as the idea of a divorce via SMS is just a really weird concept to me. We'll put it that way, because that way it's a reasonably safe statement. It's weird to me.
Well, what is an SMS, please?
That's a short message service. If you have a cell phone that works on the GSM standard, and it's starting to make its way into other standards, what you can do is basically you can send a text page to the cell phone.
Oh, have you seen that new Verizon ad where the women are driving around with their boyfriend's cell phone in their boyfriend's car laughing about how they took it?
Possibly.
Okay. I don't know. That's when you need a divorce by cell phone. But
I don't know. I personally I don't think taking off with a cell phone is a divorceable offense.
As long as they are
planning to come back.
No, there's a Verizon ad where a woman and her buddy are driving around in their ex-husband or their ex-boyfriend's car laughing about how what a great game this is to steal his car and his cell phone.
Gotcha.
And it's sexist. Okay, anyway, I'll let you go back. Hopefully somebody else will call and ask you some questions. Yeah, all right. I love your show, and I really do.
Thanks,
do
it appreciate
every
it.
All right, take it easy.
You too. Bye-bye. Okay. As long as we're on the topic of Verizon, we have this item. It also comes to us through Reuters. How are we doing on time here? Okay, we got about 10 minutes. Verizon Communications will pay about $1.5 million to the U.S. government for failing to meet performance targets related to providing rivals access to its network, and will likely make payments for months to come, a company representative said on Wednesday. The payment will be made on August 21st, and it would be the first by the nation's biggest local telephone company for such problems. SBC Communications, the second largest local phone company, has paid the federal government about $38.5 million since December, including $3.2 million last month for similar problems. There are relatively isolated cases where performance has not measured up, said Jeffrey Ward, Verizon's senior vice president for compliance. He says, I anticipate we'll be making payments to the U.S. Treasury for quite some time because perfection is a hard standard to reach. Verizon, which serves New England and the Mid-Atlantic region, agreed to meet certain performance standards and penalties for noncompliance when it won regulatory approval for the combination of Bell Atlantic and GTE to create the company. Ward said that Verizon's payments were triggered, amongst other reasons, by frequent delays in provisioning services to wholesale customers and for repeated trouble reports for customers, and that the company was working to address the problems. The payments are required when Verizon does not meet the targets for three consecutive months, and the August payment will cover April through June. To boost competition in the local telephone service market, Verizon and other dominant local carriers must open their networks to rivals before they can enter into the lucrative long-distance voice and data markets. I don't believe I need to say much about how I feel generally towards Verizon. Traditionally, the telephone company has been one of the companies that everybody loves to hate. However, my email address says it all, critter@verizoneatspoop.com. Anyway, one of these days I'm going to put together all of the reasons why I don't particularly care for Verizon and put them up on a web page somewhere. Actually, if you go to my website at www.tricityads.com, and before you start panicking, there are no ads on tricityads.com. If you go to my website at www.tricityads.com and browse through to the page for this show, you will find past episodes of this show in MP3 format, and you can download them and listen to them. And amongst them, there are previous episodes where I did discuss problems that were encountered with Verizon, and maybe at some point in time I'll dig that out and play it back and refresh everybody's memory. I think it's something that needs to be done. So let's talk about the infamous Code Red virus. There's been a lot of talk about it, and I haven't been doing very much of the talking about it. I did mention it in passing last week, I know that. But let's start with just exactly what this virus is, because a lot of people have been asking me about it. The Code Red virus, first and foremost, infects web servers. If you run a personal computer with no web server running on it, chances are very good that you are immune. Don't hold me to that. There's always a possibility. However, the Code Red virus is a virus that infects Microsoft Windows NT and Windows 2000 machines running the Microsoft Internet Information Server, or IIS. That's their web server product. And what happens is that when it infects a machine, it does basically two or three things. First of all, if the machine has its native language set to English or most other languages, and it will spawn off 300 more instances of itself and go out seeking other computers to infect. If, on the other hand, the language set turns out to be Chinese, it'll actually spawn 600 copies of itself. So this is a greater danger if you're running a Chinese web server than anything else. At any rate, it'll spawn off 300 or 600 additional copies of itself. 50% of them will go to the local, to the immediate neighborhood of the internet that your machine is located in. This is determined by address, not necessarily by physical location. Another 37% will go to a broader area, and 12% could land anywhere. It will send an attack out, exploiting a flaw in IIS, and when it gets in there, it will do the spawning like I just mentioned. It'll also drop what's called a rootkit, which is a means by which somebody can later come in and take over the control of the machine. Additionally to this, is my understanding, although I haven't validated this, that it will open up your C and D drives to the entire world to read. That's kind of scary. Especially, I believe it opens up to write it as well. At any rate, if you go to my website, which I mentioned before, www.tricityads.com, right on the front page, you'll see some statistics on how many times it's been tried to be hit. Before I headed out here, I checked it. It was somewhere around 3,400 hits, and this is inside of a week. Anyway, if you are running Microsoft IIS, Microsoft has released a patch for it. I highly recommend that you download it and install it. It also affects personal web server on Windows 2000 because of the fact that that's just basically a lobotomized version of IIS. This item is kind of interesting. It comes from SF Gate, and he said that it appears that Microsoft Corporation hasn't been practicing what it preaches. The software giant on Wednesday confirmed that some of the MSN Hotmail servers were infected with the Code Red virus. The news follows Microsoft's extensive public education campaign aimed at getting users to download a simple patch that protects servers from the virus. It wasn't immediately clear whether the infections discovered this week were caused by the first Code Red virus or a second, more virulent virus dubbed Code Red 2. Both viruses exploit a vulnerability in the company's Windows 2000 and Windows NT server software that was discovered earlier this year. Similar attacks have caused massive internet slowdowns over the past 2 weeks. Microsoft spokesman Jim Dessler says servers have since been patched and the company has been scanning its systems to make sure they're safe. "We continue to take it very seriously," he says. MSN Hotmail is a free internet service that has about 110 million registered users. Dessler said that no customer data, customer emails, or personal information appear to have been compromised in the attack. He also said the company had had no reports on slowdowns because of the attack. Anyway, we're kind of coming up on the top of the hour here. Saw DJ Toast wandering around here somewhere, so I'm expecting he'll probably come in shortly. But I'm going to call it a wrap. You've been listening to Little Brother, the show about high technology, low intelligence, and what happens when you mix them. where, like any respectable little brother, we tell him, Big Brother, my name is Chuck Ritter. This program is freely redistributable. Please feel free to send it wherever. Hey, we have a last-minute caller. Let's see what's up. Hello, caller. You're on Little Brother.
Oh, hi. This is the person who called you about the connection between Dimitri and the American.
Oh, good to hear from you.
Yeah, I just heard you talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
About how they both got released at the same time, too.
Yeah, I thought that was particularly interesting.
Yeah. did you ever see a film called The President's Analyst?
No, I can't say as I have.
Have you ever heard of it?
It sounds vaguely familiar, like I may have wandered across the title somewhere, but I would have to say not overwhelmingly so.
Well, okay. Well, never mind that.
All right.
I watched Hackers, and you recommended Hackers.
Yes.
And I also got Antitrust.
Yes. I haven't seen that one yet. I want to.
Oh, that I imagine that really upset Bill Gates, but I had a question. I had a question about Hackers, if I could.
Okay, real quick, because we are running up against
right
the hour.
Near the end of the film, when the confrontation had begun between the hackers and their adversary.
Right.
And at one point, when it was right near the climax, they said, okay, now kill the Gibson.
Yes.
What does that mean?
They were referring, all through the film, they were referring to a fictitious brand of computer. It was a Gibson.
Oh,
it was a Gibson
frame.
Computer they were working on, yes.
Yeah, okay.
That's all that was about.
Okay.
Not any real mysterious jargon, if that's the question you're asking.
Yeah. Well, I had no idea. Yeah.
Okay.
I thought it might have been. Have you been following the Catherine Harris computers getting erased?
No, I haven't, but unfortunately I'm up against the clock here and I have to get going.
Yeah, okay.
So, but I'll be here next, I'll be here in 2 weeks. So,
all right.
Give me a call in 2 weeks and we'll take it up.
Thanks.
Alrighty.
Have fun.
Take care.
Bye.
Okay, and with that we're going to wrap it up.